I've been down roads from Churchill to L.A. Met kings of speed and stars along the way. They got stories that the cameras never show. Yeah, the truth behind the fame is what we know. From the saddle to the silver screen glow, fast lanes and punch lines on a late night show. You think you've seen it all, but you don't know the half till the curtain lifts and we all have a laugh. It's not just who they are, it's how they came to be. A little horsepower, a little mystery. It's Hollywood and horsepower, baby. Take a ride where the legends laugh and the engines never hide. From the track to the spotlight, stories unwind. Yeah, the truth's a little wild and one of a kind. Hollywood and horsepower, where the real ones show. Every twist and turn is a tale you didn't know. So pour a drink, sit back, enjoy the show. Where the fast and famous let it all go.
Welcome to Hollywood and Horsepower, the show about the story behind the story. We're brought to you today by Tony's Steak and Seafood in Lexington, Kentucky, Cincinnati, Ohio, Indianapolis, Indiana, and Bowling Green, Kentucky. Tony always says there's room at the table for one more. I always say dining at Tony's is not just dinner, it's an experience, and you owe it to yourself to go. If you're anywhere close to one of their restaurants, Tony's Steak and Seafood, take the time, make a reservation. You'll thank us for introducing you to this gem of a restaurant. I'm your host, Mark Otto, host of Hollywood and Horsepower. And we are also big supporters on this network of two charities, one for the animal world, one for the human world. No Fallen Heroes is founded by a fellow naval aviator, Matt Wiz Buckley, and his wife, Susie. Matt has done a phenomenal job of helping veterans, first responders, and their families. Not just veterans and first responders, they help civilians and families as well transition and cut down on veteran suicide. We are losing way too many of these people every day, and Matt is truly doing a selfless job of trying to help these people. He's testified before Congress. He's spent a lot of his own money to make this possible, and I would ask you to take a look at their organization. If you can't do a lot, do a little. Every bit helps. On the equine and animal side, also the human side, we support Old Friends Equine, Old Friends Farm, oldfriendsequine.org. Old Friends was founded by a very close friend, like family to me, Michael Blown and his wife, Diane White. They were columnists in the Boston Globe. Take some time, look it up, look at the story. But it's an amazing place. It's the only place where you can get face-to-face with a Kentucky Derby winner or a Breeders' Cup winner or a horse you may have heard of or had the gift of being able to watch somewhere, and now you get to stand there and feed them carrots on a tour. It's a great place to spend a tour, go for an afternoon. They have events throughout the year around some of the big racing events and other things. Oldfriendsequine.org. Again, if you can't do a lot, do what you can. Every dollar helps. We do not take a penny from either organization. It's just something that we believe in. So we promote this on every show, and it's very important to us. We're joined today by none other than the man himself, Michael Blown, the founder of Old Friends Farm and the former entertainment writer for the Boston Globe. Michael, how are you doing today?
Oh, very well, Mark. Thank you. I've been listening. That was a good show you did with Jill Baffert. A nice, really nice show you did with our new president, John Nicholson, about Old Friends. It's really been a pleasure.
Yeah, it is. And I appreciate you guys always supporting the show and coming on. We have another guest today, a very close friend of mine and yours, Michael, Buck Wilson. Buck, I tell everybody that asks me, Buck is like having lunch with Hemingway. He knows a little bit about everything and a lot about many things, but I always enjoy talking to Buck, and Buck is coming to us today live from San Carlos, Mexico. the life that everybody wishes they have, sitting by the sea watching the palms sway. How you doing, Buck?
I'm doing really well. Good to hear from you guys.
Well, Michael and I did not tell Michael that you were coming on. It was kind of a surprise. I just wanted to, but I mean, we all know each other, and I wanted to today talk about movies. I mean, we always go off on tangents, but you know, Michael's background was, well, he's got several backgrounds, but one of his backgrounds was movie critic for the Boston Globe. For our listeners that don't know or understand, at the time that Michael was the movie critic for the Boston Globe, this was pre-internet. So if you had a movie come out, it was critical that there were key newspapers in the United States that you needed a good review. And Boston Globe was one of them. So in my mind, I'm not an expert like Michael is, but in my mind, I did work around Hollywood, and Boston Globe, New York Times, LA Times, those were the three points of the triangle in my world. If you didn't get a good review on those three, you kind of had a problem. So at the time that Michael was the entertainment writer, this was a big role, and it was something that everybody watched. And I kind of want to take Michael back. You know, I mean, it's fun to me. I've had the gift of being to dinner with Michael and hearing stories over the years, and that's kind of what I want to do. Buck, on the other hand, Buck grew up in Southern California. He's a walking encyclopedia for movies. So I thought, you know, the three of us together, I think we could probably come up with some pretty good conversations. And, you know, to give people a little bit of a taste, if you go out and look up Michael's reviews, which you can find on Film Affinity and many other places, you know, it's very entertaining, and also even today it's applicable. So if you're looking for an old movie, if you're looking for something, these are great places to start. So Michael, tell us a little bit, like, what is your favorite movie of all time? Not just that you reviewed, but like, everybody's got their favorite. What is it and why?
Well, you know, my favorite movie is Chinatown. And I didn't review it, but I think it's pretty close to being a perfect movie. The acting, the script, the story, it's a very complicated movie. And I've seen it now probably 15 times. And every time I see it, it's like watching, I get something else out of it. So it grows. As you get older, as we all get older, we see things differently. And I see this movie differently. And, the themes and the political and moral and social corruption that this movie examines is still apparent today.
It's almost like it was snatched out of Washington, D.C.
just transplant it.
Change the names to protect the scoundrels.
and it led to a lot of personal things for me, because I got to be friendly with John Huston, who was like my godfather, and would call people up and tell them that they should talk to me and not to be afraid to talk to me, that I'd write down what they said accurately. And that's all I wanted them to do. And the same thing with Nicholson. I mean, because of John's blessings, I got to be friends with Jack. And then if Jack, you know, if you need help on a story, or he'd make a phone call for you in a second. And so those kinds of relationships were very, very important. And both of them, of course, are integral to my favorite movie.
Okay. Buck, what was your favorite movie?
My favorite movie of all time, one that I'll put on just every so often. It's like a medicine. When you need some of your swagger back, and things aren't just right, I pop this movie on and it brings me back. And it's Casablanca. It really is. Okay, Casablanca is probably, I didn't see it until I was probably in my early 20s. And it was at a class. Yeah, I was in my early 20s. It was a class I had in college. And it was more about reviewing and style and the writing and all about that. But Bogart's character really is the first time that I can remember seeing the kind of anti-hero who is nothing but swagger, nothing but swagger. Everything is smart aleck. Everything is crossback. And I don't know, just the whole movie and how it ends up. And
well, and as you guys both know, and anybody who's been near me for more than 3 minutes, Casablanca is my all-time favorite. And I've always, I mean, I'm sitting here on the wall behind me, compliments of Michael, I have a framed budget from the Casablanca movie. I mean, it's like everything about that movie has always been interesting to me. And I know that Michael was close to this movie because you were friends with Julie Epstein. And Julie and his brother were two of the writers. And then how did Howard Koch get into it?
Well, the script's very interesting because it's, you know, obviously writing a movie script isn't the same as writing a novel or a short story. It's a group effort. And these guys all worked at Warner Brothers. They went to the studio every day to do their work, and it was a job. And sometimes, you know, they even called Julie or his twin brother, Philip Epstein, over to help another movie. They needed a comic sequence or needed another dialogue sequence. They would work on it sometimes at lunchtime while they were still working on Casablanca. What happened was Julie and Phil started working on the script, and then both of them went to Washington to protest the House Un-American Activities Committee and a lot of the stuff that was going on, the Red Scare in Hollywood.
Oh yeah, while the McCarthy crap.
Yeah, and while they were gone, they brought in Howard Koch, and Howard worked on the script. And you know, Casey Robinson, the original writer of the play that it was based on, he was called in. So everybody contributed all sorts of things, and it was a real jigsaw puzzle effort. I remember going to see a movie, I'm trying to remember the name of it now, with Tom Kahn, who played a professor up at the University of Vermont, I believe, and he was having an affair with some of his students, and it was based on a really, really, really successful novel. And I saw that it was written by Julius J. Epstein, and I called the studio and I said, look, I said, this guy might be related to the guy that wrote Casablanca. I'd like to find out about that. And they called me back 2 days later and they said it's the same guy. So I called up and I arranged to get an interview with Julie, and then we got to be friends, and we were friends all the way up until his death. In fact, when he died, I was halfway through writing his biography. And in between, Julie used to have these great dinners, Joe, at his house in Beverly Hills. And every time we went to California, Diane and I were fortunate enough to be invited to these dinners. And all of old Hollywood would show up. All some of the great old writers, Max Schulman, Ernie Lehman, who wrote, you know, North by Northwest and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and a lot of really fine movies. He would be there. And they just start telling stories, and they wouldn't stop. And it was one of the highlights of my entire life. It was just these dinners were just extraordinary. So Julie was employed by Warner Bros. He went out there in the mid 30s with his brother Philip was first, and then a year later, out there comes Julie, graduated from Penn State, who's boxing champion of Penn State, and he goes out to Hollywood like about 1935, and he starts writing scripts and doctoring dialogue, doing all those sorts of things. He told me one of the first movies he worked on that he wrote that he got full credit for was a movie called No Time for Comedy, and with Jimmy Stewart. And he said he remembered he was so proud of himself to go down to the theater and see the name of the movie up on the marquee and everything. But the marquee was so small that they only had room for part of the title of No Time for Comedy. And it, and it said on the on the on the marquee, no comedy. It's a joke that Julie really liked. But Julie tells us, you know, told stories about Ronald Reagan living in the neighborhood and the friends that he had, and then, you know, Walter Shenson, who produced A Hard Day's Night, and Sheldon Leonard, who produced all the great TV shows, I Spy and Make Room for Daddy. All these people would come to this dinner, and they start telling stories, and you would just start laughing from the moment they got there until you left. I mean, it was just extraordinary, and it really showed you what kind of a community Hollywood was. And unfortunately, so many things, because of, you know, modern technology and isolation, there's not much of that going on anymore. There's not as much socialization like there used to be.
No, there definitely isn't. In fact, it's interesting. You know, it used to be, in fact, I was just talking to somebody about this the other day. You know, it used to be there was definitely a community and a camaraderie in Hollywood. I mean, it was very much, you know, a group of, you know, people work together. And it was interesting that, you know, if somebody needed a job to keep their benefits, and, you know, for people just joining us, we're joined by today by, you know, former movie critic Michael Bowen and our good friend Buck Wilson talking about old movies. And, you know, back then, you know, and I think still, you know, if you had a SAG card, Screen Actors Guild, you had to work a certain amount to maintain your benefits. And you know, if somebody needed some work, somebody would figure out a way to get them in something. And that just doesn't happen that much anymore. You know, those days are gone where people kind of watched out for each other.
Yeah, you know, Mark, I just remembered one of the great things about these dinners with Julie, they would occur like every 6 months. And the first dinner we ever had, an actress named Gloria Stewart, who was actually, I think she started her career in the late 20s.
Oh, wow.
And she was auditioning for this movie. And at that point, she was well into her 80s. And every time we went out for another dinner, she'd say, "I'm still auditioning for the movie. I'm still auditioning for the movie." And then she got the role. And, of course, that was the role she had as the narrator of Titanic. And,
oh, wow.
And so everybody, when the last time we saw her was at Julie's at Julie's house when she got nominated for the Oscar. So that,
it,
you know, those sorts of things just don't happen anymore. Everything's so manufactured now. Even in those days, you could go on the set of a movie and hang out for a couple of days and really write about what was going on. Nowadays, I think a lot of it's real prefab. You know, you don't have any access like that anymore. They just look at you as another cog in the sales machine to sell their products. And
yeah.
And so you never get a feeling of it. I mean, every movie set I was ever on, no matter how congenial people were, seemed to be, there was always arguments. And that's what made the movie so interesting. The director arguing with an actor, actor arguing with a cinematographer, a screenwriter complaining that, you know, they're changing his lines, and all out of all this confusion, sometimes a great movie would emerge. But you don't get that flavor anymore. It all seems so prefab now. But maybe I'm just a cynical old person.
No, I think you're right. I think a lot of it has changed, and I mean, even the editing has changed. The one place, and I think you'll appreciate this, I feel like the one segment in the industry that still kind of maintains that integrity is actually the comedy side. And the reason I say that is when you look at the people, especially that came out of Second City and SNL, like Adam Sandler and Spade and Carvey, they really do a lot to try and include their friends. Like if you look at any of Sandler's movies, he puts all comedians in. I mean, he'll grab people off stand-up stages and put them in, even if it's a cameo spot, just to get people started. And, you know, Dennis Miller was like that. He did a lot to help guys get started. And I've always felt like that side of it, but I agree with you. Like the studio side, it definitely feels a lot more compartmentalized than it used to be. I mean, like, I remember you telling stories about, and I wanted to ask you about it, was like, you know, the Jaws movie. You know, I mean, the stories are legendary of how much, you know, how many challenges they had on the set and, you know, the budget and the calendar and everything else. Turns out it was a blockbuster, but, you know, as they produced it, I'm sure that they had to have their doubts.
Yeah, of course. And none of them got along. I mean, you know, Richard Harris, oh my God. You know, Richard Dreyfuss and Robert Shaw hated each other. They didn't even want to be in the same scenes together. You know, aside from all the technical problems they had, and Robert Shaw's drinking, every day the Chronicle of a guy named Carl Gottlieb actually wrote a book about the making of Jaws that's very, very interesting. And those were the days when the chronicling of the making of a movie was accurate. And Carl did a great job writing the story of Jaws. And it's still available, so you can get it on the internet. It's really well worth reading because
now were you on the set of Jaws for a little bit, right?
Yeah, a little bit, very little.
Okay,
but Carl's book is what you want to read.
Okay, were the stories pretty accurate as far as like how much of a debacle it was?
Well, I wouldn't say it was a debacle. I would say it was like. Here you get Spielberg, you know, he only made, what, one other movie, and that was a TV movie, and he's a kid, and he's up against these seasoned actors and seasoned cinematographers and all these other people who have more experience, and he really doesn't know exactly how to go about his job yet. And so he's learning on the job. And so, you know, and when you're doing that and you're in charge, it's a very difficult leadership position to be in. But I think the fact that it took, it was a 5-month shoot and it ended up taking more than 2 years. And so, everything's got to come together. And it's very, very difficult to do that, even for a seasoned professional. But Steven Spielberg had so much talent and he loved making movies so much that he persevered. And when that movie came out, it was changed movie history.
And it was, you know, the story goes, I don't know if it's true or not, but the story was that once he wrapped and went back to Hollywood, he wasn't even sure that he would have a career. It actually opened well, and that was really what kind of gave it the momentum to boost him, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think he was very discouraged.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and you know what's funny? Because you hear those stories. I mean, Caddyshack is another one. I remember Ramis saying that it was like, you know, if it could have went wrong, it did. You know, they didn't, you know, they were in the wrong location. They didn't realize they were right in the flight path of Fort Lauderdale Airport. So they had all kinds of noise issues. They had all kinds of set issues. Drugs and alcohol were rampant. And, you know, they'd just come off Animal House. Animal House was relatively painless for him. And then he goes into this, and it was a little more of a bumpy ride. And I think some of those, you know, it's kind of like they turn out to be some of the best movies.
Well, to go back to what Buck was saying about Casablanca, nobody had any faith that Casablanca was going to be a hit. And it really wasn't when it first came out. It kind of dribbled out, and it was actually one of the things that catapulted Casablanca out of the shadows and into public awareness was the fact that at Harvard during their final exams they used to show Casablanca in a theater because it was a favorite of a lot of the students there, and it became an annual event. I mean, nobody was more surprised that the retroactive appreciation of Casablanca more than Julius. Julius just thought it was amazing. And when he wrote it, it was like, It's just another movie. It's just another movie. It's just another movie. You know, he didn't think about writing, you know, round up the usual suspects and all those great lines that are in Casablanca's that were attributed to him and his brother.
Well, and it's interesting to me that my understanding is when he wrote it, that really wasn't his full focus. Like his focus was there, but I meant, that was a bad way to put it. What I mean was, it was part of a multi-picture deal, and he really didn't put the time into that one that he did some of the other films that weren't nearly as successful, like Mr. Skeppington.
Skeppington came later. So
okay.
Mr. Skeppington was a gift. Well, Jack Warner wanted to, and when Casablanca did become a hit, he wanted to reward Julian Phil. And so he gave them producing credentials, and they produced Mr. Skeffington.
Okay, as Julie so they put didn't it. Write it.
Yeah, what's that?
They didn't write it?
Yeah, they wrote it too, but the producers, they were named producers, so they had to deal with Betty Davis. And Julie said, I just wanted to go back to the office and just sit down and write anything. And so I had to deal with her every single day. And he practically had a heart attack doing that job. So, yeah, but you're right, Mark. The point that you're making is so clear that these guys were hired help. They might as well have been a mechanics in an automobile automobile factory. They were putting pieces and pieces on different cars every day. I'll give you an example. The other night I watched The Big Sleep, the Howard Hawks movie, and, you know, written by William Faulkner and based on the great Raymond Chandler mystery novel. And there's a sequence in there, an uncredited sequence that involves racing and betting on horses as a metaphor for sex in a great scene between Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. And that was totally written by Julie and his brother. Philip wrote most of it. Because they called him in and they said, we need something here to juice this up a little bit. You got to give us something. So out of the blue, he came up with this brilliant scene. But they were all doing that. They would go door to door because all their offices were in the writer building. And if they were having trouble with something, they'd go to another writer and ask him for help. And you know, nine times out of the ten, they got great help and people worked together because going to Warner Brothers was like going to work at a factory.
Well, and I think for people just joining us, we're joined by Michael Bowen, former film critic at Boston Globe, and our good friend Buck Wilson, who needs to speak up. We're talking old movies, and I think one of the things that we should point out is back, you know, and you could correct me, Michael, I don't know when it started, but especially back in like the 30s, 40s, even in the 50s, the studios and the big houses would hire people. They were contract employees, both actors, writers, Lucille Ball started out that way. I mean, a lot of people started out and they actually, like you said, it was just a job. Like they went there every day and they were in whatever they put them in and they wrote whatever they wrote. And it became, you know, a way of the industry. It wasn't until later that things became more independent.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and obviously that had some really beneficial things and some negative things as well. Because the studio heads controlled everything.
Yeah, I mean, Laurel and Hardy, I think, is a good example of that. I mean, that was one of the things that they struggled with. You know, they basically belonged to the studio for a long time, and it really made it tough for them to do the things that they wanted to do.
I mean, Julie could say what he wants about Betty Davis, and I'm sure she could have been difficult to work with, and probably was. There's many, many stories about that. But the fact of the matter is, you know, she stood up to Jack Warner about her salary and about him just throwing her into these movies where she had no choice in what role she took. And she took them to court and she won.
Oh, wow. You know,
Michael,
Michael, do you know the story? Do you know the story about Sean Connery? When Sean Connery started, the very first thing, his personality being what it was, he hired a man who did nothing but track to make sure he got every dime he was supposed to have been paid. And I don't remember which movie it was, but Warner owed him like an additional $15,000 that he'd never gotten. He sued in court and won that one as well. Just because he had a man that tracked it the whole time. What about this, about using people to do just whatever? Do you know the Sammy Kahn story about three coins in the fountain?
I don't know. I'd love to hear it.
Okay. Apparently they came to him. He was, as far as writing and scores and songs and so forth, he was exactly that. They were contract players for the studio. And they said they needed the song. They needed the song for their new movie, Three Coins in the Fountain. He said, okay. He said, well, this is him telling the story. He says, okay, well, can I see the movie? No, you can't see the movie. We've got two cuts of it, and they're all off, and they're being this, and that's happening. No, you can't. He said, okay, fine. Can I see the script? No, you can't see the script. This is under wraps. We've got this. We've got this. This other thing. This guy says, look, there's three girls. The three girls, they go to Rome. There's a fountain. They place the coins in the fountain. Will they find love? Yeah, you got it. Now, write us something excellent. We'd love to have it by, you know, tomorrow at noon. So he starts writing it on just exactly that. That's all the information they were given. And he starts batting the thing out, and they changed the way the bridge played. It was almost done because of the way the tune, the way Stein came up with the tune. It was almost like they did it not as a joke, but more of a grudge. So when it gets done, they come in and they play the song, Three Coins in the Fountain, for the studio exec. And he goes, that's perfect. That's exactly what we need. He said, where do you think and how do you think we can get it done? He says, well, to tell you the truth, you've already got a full orchestra here. And they're here to record something else. And they've got Frank Sinatra to do it. And there's a holdup, and that's not going to happen. If you were to take it over there, orchestrate the thing to a full orchestra, boom, you could knock this thing out in the next 2 days. Fantastic. They go out and they do it. And that is exactly the way it wound up happening. Now, the score gets set to the film. The film gets released. It's a big hit. They also release it as a single. It's a big hit as well. And it's at some point there that they realize that there is no copyright contract on this song. Sammy Kahn and his partner Stein, they own it all. So the studio comes back and says, look, you know, we can't, you know, you guys can't own 100% of this. This is part of this and this, that, and the other. So in the end, they wound up actually signing an agreement that they gave the studio 50% ownership. They kept the other 50% because nobody took the time to figure out where the copyright was.
You know, it's so funny how that turns out. I mean, so many actors have, you know, had taken salaries when they should have taken a percentage or taken a percentage when they should have taken a salary. You know, my favorite story about making those kinds of deals is Alec Guinness didn't want to do Star Wars. He, you know, he didn't understand it. He didn't like science fiction. There's nothing about it. But he wasn't doing anything. He said, okay, I'll do it. And he's a professional actor. And it was a job. So he goes out and he does Obi-Wan Kenobi. And as part of the deal, they asked him, they said, now we'll pay you, I think, some, I think it was like $20,000 for a few days. And as the movie went on, his role got expanded. But he says, well, I'll take a percentage instead. Instead, he took a percentage. And he told me this personally when his book came out, a wonderful autobiography called Blessings in Disguise, Alec Guinness's autobiography. It's really good. He said, that movie and that decision afforded me my retirement, because you could add up everything I made from every other movie I ever made and double it, and it wouldn't still wouldn't have as much as I made from Star Wars.
That's incredible. Incredible.
So one of the other ones is when Richard Brooks was directing, was making the Blackboard Jungle, he wanted to Rock Around the Clock as the credit theme, and they wanted $500 for it. And he had to scramble around to get the $500 to pay the Bill Haley and the Comets to play the song and do that. And just before they were going to go and record the song and put it on the film, they said to him, I'll tell you what, if you come up with another $500, you can have the lifetime rights to the entire song for $1,000. And Richard didn't have the money and didn't do it. But there you go.
Can you imagine? You know, it's funny how those happen down through history. And, you know, you talk about those jingles. It's like, you know, they don't do it as much anymore, but it used to be almost every show had a theme song. And, you know, James Burroughs, who unfortunately we lost this year, I mean, just an amazing guy, brilliant mind, responsible for everything from Mary Tyler Moore, Taxi, Cheers, Friends, you know, on and on, you know, Will and Grace. He tells the story that, you know, the theme song for Cheers, which everybody knows, was actually like a last minute kind of a toss in his lap. He had gotten a song that he liked better, and at the last minute, the composer came back to him and said, I can't let you have it because somebody else has already spoken for it. And he was kind of bummed out, and they said, but I got this other one. And he sent it to him, and that's the one we all know today. So it is amazing to me how some of that stuff just kind of happens, and it's like, if you know, you wouldn't know any different today, but like we can't imagine it without it. But it is amazing. I mean, Casablanca, look at all the little nuances in there. Look at all the hidden messages, the references to World War II, and, you know, how many times that movie's been referenced in different, you know, amazing, you know, one-liners. And, you know, I can't remember, you might know, Michael, but it's in, like, the top five movie lines of all time, I think, a couple of times.
Oh, it would have to be.
Yeah.
It would absolutely have to be. Between, I mean, there is nobody who didn't know what he meant when they said The Usual Suspects. When the title of that movie came out, you knew exactly where it came from. And, you know, the Play It Again, Sam is a Mandela effect because it's never actually said in the movie. You know, Richter's gambling here. That turns up in political debates.
And at least once a week in our vernacular. I'm shocked.
Shocked, mind you. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That movie, I still, there's parts about that movie. There was a story I heard that Michael Curtis, when he was directing, that's for Casablanca, actually told Bogart in the scene where he's standing at the top of the staircase looking down at Ingrid Bergman as she's walking out. His direction at the time, at least that's what we were told, was hit the cigarette once, point your eyes down, and look bored. And they said, and when you see it, if you, now that you know that, watch it again, and that's exactly what he does. The reason it hits so hard is because of the score and the cut and the circumstance. But that piece of direction, just look over the, just look down and look bored. It works brilliantly.
Well, and it's amazing to me that, you know, the movie, you know, still holds today. I mean, it still gets played very often. I don't think you could run into a person who doesn't know Casablanca. It got the Academy Award for Best Director, Best Picture, Best Writing and Screenplay. It was nominated for Best Actor for Bogart, Best Actor in a Supporting Role for Claude Rains, Best Cinematography, Best Editing, and Best Music. I mean, it's amazing how many awards it's gotten over the years and how much it still plays. Let me ask you, Michael, did it open strong? I mean, when it came out, was it an instant hit, or was it one of those movies that grew over time?
No, it definitely grew over time. It wasn't was in here. Julie said at the time, he said, just another movie. Let's go on to the next one. Let's go on to the next one. No big deal. And then very, very slowly it started to develop an audience. And I forget who did the story on the students at Harvard watching it during every exam period, and that gave it a huge boost. And then it caught on from there, but it mostly it caught on in its second run, not in the first run.
It's amazing how many times that happens where they turn into evergreens because, you know, the audience, I don't know if they get educated to it or just grows on them, but I mean, several comedies are like that even. I mean, it's like they come out and today we think of them as blockbusters, but they really didn't open strong. Is there a lot of movies down through history that come to mind when you think of that really weren't that strong coming out of the gate, but turned out to be, you know, kind of classics?
Well, you know, one of the things about that opening movies and whether they open strong or not, it's become so important now. The advertising budgets and everything else would depend on that opening weekend. And if you don't open strong the opening weekend, it disappears. And then some of it happened much later on, even in television, like a movie like A Christmas Story that's become such a cult favorite, you know, shown 24 hours during Christmas, time after time after time. You know, when that first came out in Boston, it played in a softcore porn house because it was an independent production. They couldn't even get a theater. And I remember going to see it on a Friday afternoon, and that was one of the few times I was actually right about a movie. I just thought it was fabulous, and I liked, you know, I was a fan of Gene Shepard, whose writings it was based on. But I mean, that movie didn't really catch on until it was on television because it couldn't find an audience. And what would happen to little independent movies like that is if they didn't do well, they'd get kicked out of the theaters because they didn't have the power that the major distributors had to say, okay, well, if you don't play this for another week or two, we're not going to give you an X picture or a Y picture. So they're powerless to do anything against the corporate so-called wisdom of the distributors.
And you know, another one I've always heard about is Citizen Kane. Did Citizen Kane open strong?
No.
So that's another perfect example.
Well, you know, William Randolph Hearst would allow him to advertise it in all of his newspapers. Wouldn't take any ads for it. I mean, it was a real cause celeb. But again,
and
you know,
I really
the brilliance
look at
of
Citizen
the movie.
Kane. Citizen Kane is like the Beatles. You know, it's like you hear people that are like, you know, I don't like it, or I think, yeah, I don't like the Beatles. And I always say, you know, stop it. You know, the Beatles, you know, like, you know, Paul McCartney's Mozart. You don't get it, but you will. You know, at some point you're going to get perspective and you'll understand what it is. I feel like Citizen Kane's the same way. If you don't get it, you will. At some point, it's going to equip you. And, you know, the movie is another movie that has so many different messages within the movie. It's crazy. None bigger being than what's Rosebud.
It's a good example. It's a brilliant movie, obviously. Most people consider it the best movie ever. And that's
another one where, you know, he was really young. Like Orson, was that his first big movie?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Came from the theater. I think he was 26.
Yeah, he was young, which is amazing that he put that thing together like he did. I mean, you know, again, brilliantly done, brilliantly written. I always enjoy movies that have multiple layers to them. You know, I mean, you know, my daughter Grace, you know, I have two kids, she's in Grace, both really smart. Grace, as Michael and Buck know, she's very, very smart, especially when it comes to movies. And you know, one of the things that I always like talking about movies with Grace is that she sees things that you don't see. She notices things that are just, you know, in the back. You know, she likes how it's written. She likes the set. She likes supporting pieces. And I think that's something, to me, that comes out in Citizen Kane. You know, it's like you see all these pieces within the movie.
It's brilliant on so many levels, from the cinematography to, you know, Joseph Cotten's brilliant in it. You know, Orson Welles obviously brilliant. But, you know, it's a great example of people that are putting up the money for the movie, allowing the people that they hired to create the movie complete artistic freedom. And that's what Orson Welles got on that movie. And he never got it again. That was it. And there were a lot of forces that were up against him, including William Randolph Hearst, who was not only controlled so much of the media, but he also, you know, controlled a lot of the political environment as well. And he was up against, so Orson was up against that kind of pressure, and he still persevered. And the movie's just brilliant.
And, you know,
all right, gentlemen, I'm going to go ahead and say it. The word that always comes up whenever it has to do with something creative, like a movie or a song or a record or whatever, is when it works, and it's mostly because of intangibles. There are intangibles. Sometimes it just works. I cannot explain why, but I do not like Citizen Kane. I've watched it multiple times.
I cannot get
a finger on exactly what it is about that movie that I don't care for, but I simply, it's not my cup of tea.
In all fairness, and I understand it, and you know, you're one of the brilliant minds to me, but with Citizen Kane, I felt the exact same way. And then one day I watch it on a plane, just out of boredom, only title I really recognized, and something just clicked. And from that point on, I've probably watched it 3 times a year since then. So I completely understand where you're coming from, but at some point, I promise you, you'll look at it and it'll be like, oh yeah, I get it. It's kind of like the Beatles. Like I said, I never really was into the Beatles. I know that's cardinal sin to even say that out loud. But, like, now I get it, and I listen to them, and it's like, yeah, now I get it. There are so many, you know, different rhythms and so many different riffs and melodies and the writing and the music. And, you know, they were brilliant. But, like, when I was younger, it didn't click. You know, I think Citizen Kane kind of along that line. Like, at some point you see it, and it's like, oh yeah, now it's like I kind of see what the hype is, but it's also like I think the history of the movie also is really interesting to me. It wasn't a really smoothly run, you know, come out. I mean, it was like, you know, it didn't start strong. It grew over time. It was one of those evergreens, but it definitely has become part of cinema history, and I feel like it's one of those ones that will just always be around. And to your point, you know, some of these ones don't come out strong. You know, I remember, you know, David Spade saying, you know, Tommy Boy didn't really open that strong. And to your point, you know, of the intangibles, sometimes I think it's also what else is going on. And the one that always comes to my mind is, you know, Selleck dancing in Gutenberg's Three Men and a Little Lady. You know, Three Men and a Baby opens, and it's just explosive, blockbuster. They come do Three Men and a Little Lady, and it's like, oh, this is like slam dunking off a stepladder. And as Selleck was said in an interview recently, he said, you know, he kind of laughs about it now, but he says, you know, right before it's ready to release, the studio mentions to him, you know, I think we're going to be okay. There's really nothing out there. There's this little film called Home Alone, but we don't see it as a problem. Well,
yeah.
And an interesting
I will go back and see
I have a connection to Home Alone. Home Alone, the original one, was shot at a former boss's house, none other than the infamous Bob Creedon in Chicago.
Maybe it was a Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah, a Nightmare on Bob Street. I guess from that point on, his neighbors just hated him.
Trust me, they hated him well before the movie was made.
Yeah, they just didn't have the joy of getting to know him like we did. So what was your biggest surprise, Michael? Like, what's a movie that you reviewed that you really liked and it took it a while to get its momentum?
Well, I reviewed a lot of movies favorably that didn't do well at the box office at all. And then conversely, I'm like one of the only people in America, and I deeply regret this because I think it's a really funny movie, but for some reason, when I first saw Animal House, I said, this is the stupidest movie. None of it's funny. It's just ridiculous. And, you know, who cares? And panned it. And Diane, my wife, she never let me forget that. 150 years of marriage, and she still won't let me forget that I panned Animal
House. Have to tell the story about them coming and taking you to lunch.
Yeah. Well, they took me to lunch. The cast came and took me to lunch because they wanted to find out how they could get better at their jobs. I mean, it was hilarious. They threw rolls at me. And it was fun. It was
fun. From what I understand, the entire cast came, right?
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
Even pretty Belushi? Much.
No, he didn't come. But everybody
else. He
didn't
come. Did. Okay. No. Was Ramis there?
Oh, yep. Yep. John Landis was there.
And Doug, or was
Karen
Doug already gone?
Was there?
I saw that movie in the theater. I saw Animal House in the theater. I saw it with my dad. Okay, I can't exactly tell you. I thought it was the greatest movie ever done. Now remember the year, okay? And remember that I was very young at that time, and I could not wait to get to college if this is what it was going to be like. So that's probably what he was thinking about. So I'm looking at it now. Oh, yeah, 1978. I'm 15 years old. Yeah. So I'm in the theater with my dad while all of this is going on. When the movie is over, my dad turns and looks at me and says, what the was that? he had no idea what if there was a plot, what had happened, why anybody liked it, what was the thing. I thought it was, and still, in college, if you go down the lines, Caddyshack, Animal House, Dr. Detroit, and Eddie Murphy's Delirious was, I mean, literally something of that amongst our crew was playing 24/7. You couldn't go anywhere that wasn't on, and I could probably recite Caddyshack from memory, the number of times that I've seen it. But Animal House is along the same way.
And I'll give you a fun piece of Animal House trivia. Did you know that they wanted Aykroyd to play D-Day? So they were wanting Aykroyd to be in it with Belushi and play D-Day, and Aykroyd bowed out because he didn't feel like he could leave Lauren at SNL. He kind of looked around and was like, okay, Belushi's gone, Chevy's gone, Murray was gone. It's like, I can't just walk out on it. So he stayed, and that was the reason that he wasn't an Animal House.
That's amazing.
I probably would have loved it if he was.
I would have, too. And I loved, you know, the way it was. I mean, the cast of Animal House, I like it. But it would, you know, I'm a huge Aykroyd fan. I mean, he's a brilliant mind, brilliant actor. I mean, he's super smart, probably one of the sharpest guys in the business, especially on the comedy side, you know, as he's famous for. You know, he's the one that always says, you know, don't forget the business. It's called show business. Always take care of your business. You know, he's a really, really sharp mind, and he's just funny. I mean, he's just a brilliant guy. I know that Michael has a hard out coming up here, so he's going to have to say goodbye to us. I do have to ask you, Michael, and I can't thank you enough for talking movies with us, But I have one big question that I always forget to ask you. What is your favorite studio that you've ever worked with over time?
I think probably Warner Brothers.
Yeah, I would say too. Warner Brothers is so steeped in history that.
Yeah.
And going on Warner Brothers, you feel like you're going back in time.
Yeah, and you know it was a great studio because you could walk around it, you could pop into sound stages. It wasn't security everywhere.
Once you're inside, it was like a city within a city, because I used to call on them too. And once you were inside, it was kind of amazing how you could just kind of walk around, and it was pretty cool. One other question, Michael. What's your favorite restaurant in Boston, and what's your favorite restaurant in Hollywood?
Well, my favorite one in Hollywood is obviously Musso and Frank's.
Musso and Frank's. The menu hangs on the wall behind me, by the way.
Oh, that's great.
And you know when from? When you and I were there. Remember, we were out there for Breeders' Cup and we went to Musso and Frank's? I have the menu from that night, and it's framed on the wall behind me.
Wow. That's when we could almost afford it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And for people who don't know it, Musso and Frank's, there have been more movie deals put together in that restaurant than I would argue anyplace else in Hollywood. The Brown Derby gets a lot of credit. I think Musso and Frank's should get more.
Yeah. You know, there were a lot of good restaurants out there, but you know, as Buck was pointing out, you know, sometimes it's just the peripheral things, the things that are seemingly minor and seemingly insignificant that end up being the most important things, like, you know, running into people. Serendipity plays such an important role in all of this.
No question.
And serendipity certainly played a role in Casablanca. I mean, just crazy how they came up with some of the greatest lines in movie history just by driving around and running into other people and all of a sudden getting an idea for a long. It didn't come from sitting in front of the typewriter all the time.
No, I would completely agree. And it's also like many writing, like you said, you put a few writers in a room, doesn't matter if it's comedy, screenplay, whatever it is, it's always going to get shinier and brighter. I mean, you throw an idea out and then somebody else adds to it, somebody else adds to that. And that's really, that collaboration is really how, you know, you come up with the best work. And I still like doing that today. I mean, that's one of the best ways to write is to get, you know, and unfortunately for us, you know, we all share that group of friends that we all kind of have that third eye where, you know, as a great comedian once said, he goes, you know, we have the jokes the night of the plane crash. We just know we can't say it out loud. So it's like it's that mind that helps create stuff. What was your favorite restaurant in Boston?
Well, I'm still waiting for Tony's Steakhouse. I'm waiting for Tony to open up a branch in Boston. I'll go back there.
Absolutely. Tony's is the place to go. I mean, we've had some great dinners there and we'll have some more there. We need to put one of those to get together again because I kind of miss going there.
That'd be great. Well, I'm gonna have to say goodbye. My tour is here. We're gonna go around and see our celebrities.
All right, sir. Well, I can't thank you enough. Buck and I are gonna continue for a little bit, but thank you so much, Michael. Really appreciate you joining us today. It was Michael Blowen, former movie critic for the Boston Globe, founder of Old Friends Farm. Ladies and gentlemen, if take a minute, take a look at oldfriendsequine.org. Old Friends was founded by Michael and his wife. They help retired racehorses, and quite frankly, they help a lot of people. There's been as much healing for people as there has been for horses. If you can't do a little, or if you can't do a lot, do a little. Do what you can. Every dollar helps. Michael, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it very much. And, you know, Buck, give us your feedback now. What were your top movies that you watched early on that didn't really take off, but you thought it was going to be off the charts? It just stuck with you.
Let's see, a movie that I saw that I couldn't understand why it didn't get more.
We were talking about, I know one that we were talking about earlier, was The Pope of Greenwich Village.
I loved The Pope of Greenwich Village when I saw it.
In fact, I forgot to ask Michael about that. He didn't love it.
No. Give me a second. I'm going to tell you the name because I remember seeing afterwards. I remember seeing afterwards and talking about it. It was Geraldine Page. Geraldine Page, old veteran Hollywood actress, plays the mother of the crooked police officer. And she smokes like a chimney. I mean, during the movie, she is just never without a cigarette, smokes like a chimney, always coughing. You can tell by the she's color is bad, everything. And what sold it was Geraldine Page didn't smoke. So they gave her the cigarettes, and they were, in those days, nobody had thought, you know, maybe we should make cigarettes out of like tea or out some herbal thing or something like that for these people, because they're going to be constantly smoking trying to get a scene done. All they're going to do is smoke five packs a day while we're doing it. They just gave her cigarettes, and the cigarettes were making her sick, and it looked great on film. And I remember hearing that and just going, wow, that's some dedication right there. But it paired off perfectly. If you put those two guys together, you know, Mickey Rourke and Eric Roberts standing side by side creates immediate tension. In real life, you just knew there's no way those guys liked each other, period. There's no possible way. But they're supposed to be two guys who are very close, but there's always a tension there. And the storyline I thought was great. The supporting characters were great. The score was all old New York. I think they mostly were playing Sinatra's The Summer Winds. No, I absolutely love that movie when I saw it. You know, the movie I'm thinking of right now that it didn't go where I was at the time when that movie came out, and I'm talking about Billy Jack. I was in Southern California, so it went crazy in Southern California right out of the gate. But it didn't open as well as they had thought. There was an earlier movie that Tom Laughlin did. It was called The Born Losers, and that's where he starts that character of Billy Jack. But the movie that he wound up getting to make was not the movie he wanted to make. He wanted to make a movie that was basically a political statement about specifically about the treatment of Native Americans. That was the movie he wanted to make. He'd been trying to get that movie going since like the late 1950s. When they finally get the movie The Born Losers out, it turns into it's the same character about the ex-Green Beret, but he winds up against a biker gang. When they come back in, the next movie turns into on the reservation, this, that, and the other, but it was more like a national political statement about a conflict of cultures. And it wasn't understood everywhere, but it blew up big enough, it spawned four sequels. So it had to touch a nerve somewhere.
Some of these movies take on a life of their own. And, you know, back to Casablanca, our favorite movie, you know, and it was mine and yours. So I looked it up, and, you know, here's the – we'll have a little trivia here. See where your Casablanca is, which I know I won't be able to stump you, but I'll try anyhow.
No, but
so,
I bet you can.
I'm going to give you the top quotes. You tell me which character said it. Here's looking at you, kid. Obvious.
Rick.
We'll always have Paris. Most of these are going to be his. Of all the gin joints in all the towns of the world. So these are the top quotes out of the movie. We were trying to think of all the quotes that came out of it. Play it again, right. Sam. Lewis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. And here's the famous one, the one that, you know, we should have engraved on our headstones. I'm shocked to tell you that the gambling is going on here. The quad ring.
Yeah, Louis gets it as a lane.
But it is,
you know, my favorite line from the movie, actually. No, but my favorite line from the movie is, you know, I came to Casablanca for the waters.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did. Yeah.
Okay, so
we're in the middle of the desert. Yeah. I was misinformed. Yeah. That's the whole character in a nutshell right there.
You know, and that's the other thing about Casablanca that I really like. For people that are just joining us, I'm joined by my good friend Buck Wilson. Michael Blowen, the Performance Field Critic for the Boston Globe, was with us. He had a hard out at the top of the hour, so he had to exit. But, you know, we're talking movies and movie history. And, you know, one of the things that I always like in a movie, and same thing my daughter Grace likes, is when you have a movie that what I would call is multi-layered. So you have the actual plot, you know, the surface plot of Casablanca, which is obviously, you know, an escape point during World War II to the Americas. And then underlying in that was messages about standing up against Germany. And, you know, the most famous scene that comes to my mind was the singing in the bar, where the Germans start singing at them, and then, you know, the orchestra, you know, who was it? And I'm drawing a complete blank. You know, the Laszlo stands up and starts the opposition, and with Rick's approval, the orchestra joins in, and they drowned out the Germans and sit them down. And, you know, when you really think about it, this movie was released in 1942. We're in the heart of World War II. You know, I mean, this was a time that there's a lot of tension throughout the world, and that was a pretty bold move. You know, I mean, that was a, you know, punch in the nose to Germany at the time, and I'm sure that that came with a certain amount of risk. I know that, you know, Michael was kind enough that years ago, knowing that this was my favorite movie, he shared his file on Casablanca with me. And so I have, like, the budget from the movie, and I have, you know, some of the edit notes. And it's funny to me, the one of the things that really stood out to me was, you know, in the edit notes, how, you know, the things that they fought over were not what you would have thought of. It was not like, oh, there's this language or that language. There were things like the insinuation that, you know, Laszlo's wife was having an affair with, you know, Bogart. That was a controversy. You know, there's a lot of etiquette things that came out in there that they really were, you know, Jack Warner did not like. And it went back and forth. And I've got actual letters between, you know, the directors and Jack Warner going back and forth, you know, arguing, you know, what they could and couldn't include. So I've got a piece here that you'll find interesting, and I may have showed this to you before, but, you know, in going down through it, you know, to give people a perspective, you know, the salaries for Casablanca were so, you know, it was not an expensive movie, you know. So, I mean, when you look at it, it's like, you know, the cast salaries, Humphrey Bogart received $36,000 and he was the highest paid. You know, Green Street got $7,500. Paul Henry Laszlo received $25,000 and LeBeau, you know, which was Laszlo's wife, got She received $25,000 also. Claude Rains got $22,000. You know, and then it goes down from there. And some of the people got, you know, very little. So, you know, a surprising one.
Okay, hang on a second. Two quick things. Number one, I just did the math on it.
$36,000 in 1942, because remember, we are, I don't know when in 1942. Remember, we're still in, we are just trailing out, of the Depression in 1941 in December.
Well, here we still would have been
in. America gets in the war. Okay, so in 1942, okay, you are still, the country is gearing up, the economy is coming on, unemployment goes to under 2%, which is still considered the gold standard. There's a whole deal going on, but even with that said, just as a matter of what in real GMP, what a dollar was worth comparatively, the $36,000 that Bogart got paid today would be worth $737,000.
That's fair. No, that's fair. And another thing to point out, too, at that time, and I don't know exactly what his deal was, but there's no reference to it in this budget, but I don't believe they received any royalties on it either, did they?
Oh, I wouldn't believe.
What they got.
And those, no royalties. No royalties, no.
So that's the other
thing. Not unless he had something negotiated.
Because, like, that's the other thing to point out, like, what Michael was alluding to is that, you know, sometimes people would have been better off taking the salary. Sometimes they would have been better off taking the percentage. And, you know, back then, I'm sure they weren't even offered the percentage because they were employees. And, you know, and then you jump up to, like, the writing and the screenplay. And, you know, the Epstein brothers got $15,000 apiece, which was pretty good money for that at that point for a writer. You know, Howard Koch got $4,200. So
it, I think that in perspective, the average hourly wage. I'm looking this up now because it all fits. The average hourly wage in 1942 was 68 cents. Average income was $1,900. So it isn't that they didn't get paid well, but the budget of, you know, think about that, man. Think about what happened when Henry Ford was offering his workers $5 a day. What in the year that happened in? Henry Ford offered him $5 a day. That was a fortune. You got any and everybody. Kept all the best. Now, as you will, of course, have projected, that meant that you put up with a lot in those days for $5 a day.
Well, he basically owned it.
Yeah.
And he made no bones about it.
$5 a day?
No, yeah. What I mean was the way, you know, and it's no secret, I'm not talking out of school, but he was not the easiest guy to work for. I mean, the rumors and the stories are rampant of him doing just outlandish things. And, you know, it's funny, you know, you go back and we're jumping around a little bit, but, you know, talking about that, you know, in business, my absolute hero, the guy that I always looked up to was, you know, Lee Iacocca. And Iacocca, you know, talked about the fact that, you know, some of the quirks and, you know, it was like, He was a absolute dictator, you know, Henry Ford. And I know my dad worked and lived in Detroit, you know, a lot of his life, and he tells stories of, you know, the stories were endless of the stuff he did, you know, making guys stand on the line and wet their pants because they couldn't have a bathroom break. You know, so I mean, maybe I remember the stories go on of him being mad at the engineers because they didn't design something right, and locking the gates and making them walk home from work and walk back the next day to teach them a lesson. They couldn't take their cars out. You know, there's stuff like that. I mean, you couldn't get away with it today, but he was notorious for doing the crazy kind of stuff like that. So it is kind of crazy. So, you know, same thing I asked Michael. Of all the places you've been, I mean, you're probably one of the most well-traveled guys I know, all over the world, you know, and I think I know the answer to this, probably for sentimental reasons, but what is your absolute favorite restaurant?
Oh, wow. My,
Isn't it in Indianapolis for obvious reasons?
You know, if I was putting a steakhouse list together, St. Elmo's Steakhouse in Indianapolis, where my wife and I got married. Yes, that's a great choice. You've brought up
the
Russo
lovely
and Frank's.
Like the rest
dinner
of
we had out there. We had dinner at Musso and Frank's during Breeders' Cup that one year.
Yeah, Musso and Frank's
was a wonderful meal. Can I tell a story about the two of us?
Yeah.
I can tell a story? Okay, well, we are at the Palm in Nashville, Tennessee, and it's in conjunction with a trade show. I won't say which one. And we were working together at the time, and I won't say which company.
Yeah, don't name the guy.
I won't say which company.
Or Jeff.
Okay. And we had guests. Okay. And let's say we ran up quite a tab. It was a brilliant meal. We started with appetizers, a couple bottles of wine, nice cocktails. We are famous for over-ordering, so naturally we had more salad than we needed, but we ate it. We had more food than we needed, but we ate that too. But we made quite a show of ourselves. And at the end of it, I get the tab.
We're feeling pretty good about ourselves.
Yeah, feeling good about ourselves. And I look at the tab, and it averaged out to just a little over $200 a piece for four people.
And one of the guests that was?
One of the guests hears a total, which was in excess of $200 a piece, and says, well, at least we didn't overdo.
Exactly.
And I said, well,
it's important to keep things in perspective. I've got a story for you along that same line. As you know, my favorite restaurant is the Palm. And I've always loved the Palm. I think I loved the history about it. I liked the If the Walls Could Talk place. As you well know, the Palm Miami, if I had to pick one, that's kind of home for me. And I know the people there, the team is amazing, from Mumbles and Michael and everybody, you know, they make you feel welcome. They're terrific people. And, you know, anytime Margie and I are there, we go there for dinner. You know, it's just one of those places you can't not go to. Grace and I are there, my daughter, and we go there. I believe it was like at Christmas time or something. And this was shortly after, like the same year, I would always ask for the same table. You know the table I'm talking about. The table I would always ask for people that are just joining us. I'm with my friend Buck Wilson. We had Michael Blown with us. We've been talking movies and restaurants. And my favorite restaurant is the Palm. And the Palm, New York, was a landmark. To me, the Palm, Miami is another one. And when I would always walk in, there was a corner table in the back room next to a half wall, and it was the perfect vantage point. You could see the main dining room, but yet you had a little bit of privacy. So I would always ask him. Every time I'd go in, I'd be like, can I have that table in the corner? And Michael, one day, the manager, when I walk in, he said, look, you don't even have to ask. He said, when you make a reservation, we're going to put you in the corner. That's your table. I'm like, okay. And to this day, for what it's worth, I make a reservation. That's where they put me. So we walk in, and they were busy, and Michael just kind of puts his arm on and he says, hey, how you guys doing? And I have my daughter with me, and he says, your table's ready. Go ahead. And Grace looks at me, and she says, really? You and Sinatra both have a table at the Palm? And I said, that's true, but my table's in a better spot.
Exactly.
He could always count on Grace to bring you back. Really? You and Sinatra?
Yeah, for sure.
So what was your favorite restaurant growing up in Southern California? Like, what's a place that you remember going as a kid?
Oh. Backing it up that far, we had... I can tell you that my dad being my dad, one of the places that at least once a year we'd wind up in was the Brown Derby.
Oh, yeah.
And, okay, and I'm sorry I remember it as a kid, where, to a point anyway, where it's going to be the Brown Derby and, you know, the life just falls out of you. This means I've got to put on clothes I don't like, sit where I don't want to be, don't do whatever else.
Well, to quote Wally from Leave It to Beaver, when Beaver says, you know, why do we have to have good manners? He's like, Beaver, you don't think we're going out to dinner to have fun, do you?
Yeah, there you go. That was kind of the way I felt 100% about it. Okay. Leave me alone. I want to eat the food off the table. Come on. But about 12, somewhere into the 12, 13 range, we pulled that sun off and we went in there and it was like, I don't know, it was like the place morphed. All of a sudden it was, wow, this is nice. So I used to actually, when I was in high school, I don't know how many times I did it, maybe four or five times, but if I had a girl that I wanted to impress, that's where I took her.
Brown Derby. You know what's funny? So I have shot glasses from the original Brown Derby, not the remake, but the original Brown Derby with the logos on it. And I also have them from Dean Martin's restaurant.
Oh.
I can't remember what it was called. It was something. But, it, you know, he had a restaurant there in L.A. And I've got glasses from that one. So it's kind of interesting. Okay. You know, it is amazing how those stick in your head. You know what's funny about that? You grew up a lot like I did. You know, my parents took me to wherever they were going. And I'm very thankful for that because I did the same thing with Keith and Grace, as you know. Any place we were going, they just went. And I really think as much as it was a grind for us as kids, you look back on it, and my son and I were talking, Keith and I were talking about this, and he's getting to the point, you know, he's in his first real career job, and he's traveling, and he's going to dinners and different things. And he's getting a little bit of a perspective on business dinners and etiquette. And it's something interesting that if you grew up with that, with your parents taking you to what I would call a white tablecloth restaurant, and we all know what that means, You kind of learn, you know, not just which one's the salad fork, but some etiquette, you know what I mean? A little bit. I mean, I'm sure not to our mother's standards, but at least some. In perspective, we've all been out to dinner with people that obviously didn't have that. And I've always told my kids, when they would question, yeah, putting it politely, told my kids, you know, it's important to do these things so that you don't embarrass yourself and the people that you're with. You know, I mean, you need to learn a certain amount of etiquette, a certain amount of table manners, so you can function at a business dinner or even just a dinner with friends and not embarrass yourself or the people you're with. You know, we do have to tell the story because we touched on it, and I think it's important, not just because, you know, we owe it to her, but Buck is married to a brilliant woman, Trina. I've always said, you know, I've always looked up to Trina, and I've always kind of admired your guys' relationship. You guys started your relationship. I shouldn't say that. Back up. You didn't start your relationship, but you got married at a restaurant, which I always have thought that was a cool story. You know, I like restaurants. I mean, obviously, as you put it, we go to three places for dinner, order four appetizers, two entrees, we spill a drink, and then we head to the next restaurant. And, you know, restaurants have always been, I don't know why. I mean, I think it's just a social aspect of being with friends and family. And, you know, I just enjoy it. I do to this day, even though I don't eat as much anymore. But, you know, you guys got married at St. Elmo's Steakhouse in Indianapolis. It was in the wine cellar, was it?
Yep, we were in the wine cellar down below. We had made the decision that we were going to get married close in Indianapolis to Trina's family. That's where she's from. Her brother has MS, and we didn't want to try to make him travel too far. And St. Elmo's was our place to go when it was just the two of us when we were in Indianapolis visiting family. So they gave us the wine cellar. They gave us two dedicated waiters downstairs. There was no restriction on the menu. I picked a white wine. I picked a red wine, and it never stopped coming. We had a dinner party, basically, for 17 people.
In the wine cellar. And you set up tables in the wine cellar, and you had dinner right in there?
Right in there.
That's
and
pretty
as
cool.
far as the rest of it is concerned, I don't offer this as advice. It's simply a matter of fact. But if you have a brother-in-law who's a preacher, it's convenient. You just basically have a dinner party, and somewhere between the appetizer and the entree, my brother-in-law David said, "Is now good?" And I said, "Yeah, now it's good." So we got up and we got married. And that was
and
we
Jimmy
sat back
Buffett.
Down, finished that appetizer.
Jimmy and Jane, their wedding was kind of like that. I remember Jimmy telling the story that, you know, when they sent it out, they said, "Look, we're going to get married." It was at a farm outside Aspen, and you know, we're going to have a party at some time during the party. We're going to exchange vows, and the party will go until it ends. And I think sometimes those are the greatest stories. I mean, it is interesting to me. Like, you know, as we wrap this up, it's like, it's amazing to me how you kind of have memories of certain places and times that really stick. For me, I don't know if this is the same for you, but for me, it's like restaurants are really key to that. And I think that's one of the reasons I always talk about places on this show. You know, Margie's, you know, her and I've been together now for a little over a year, and, you know, she's very important to me. And, you know, again, much like you, definitely, you know, going up in a relationship, I look up to her constantly, brilliant person, amazing person. But, you know, her and I met the first time at Eddie Merlot's. To this day, that's like a special place. You know what I mean? It's like the Palm will always be my favorite restaurant, but Eddie Merlot's is definitely holds a spot because it's a night I'll never forget. And I think that kind of, you know, like St. Elmo's for you. I mean, you know, I just, it's interesting to me how you hear people tell stories, and I have the same ones where it's like certain people, places, time, and it seems like it wraps a lot around food and restaurants. And I think that kind of explains like today's show. You know, it's like, that's one of the things I always liked about Hollywood. That's one of the things I always liked about horse racing. Working in Hollywood, working in horse racing, it's amazing how many times, and you can attest to this, it's like, you know, you have an event or you're working all day, but it's like then you end up at a restaurant with, you know, 8, 10, 12 friends, and you sit around, tell stories, and laugh all night. And I don't know if that's something that's in every industry, but it definitely is in our industry, and that's I think that's another reason why I really like it. I mean, do you kind of have that same feeling? Like, is that a core, you know, like a cornerstone for you, like different restaurants at time?
Oh, absolutely. The business that we were in, right now I can probably name places off for Chicago, Boston, Orlando,
Miami.
We were there working, Miami especially. But every place we worked, no matter how miserable the day was or what happened, you knew where you were going to have dinner. How many times did like Malone's back in Lexington? You know, it was a mess, but we made it to Malone's, right?
Malone's,
no matter what.
Tony's. You know, Tony's was another cornerstone on that one that was sponsored this show. You know, Tony's was Frank and Dino's. You know, it is. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, and then there's the cornerstones like, and you know, it's funny. I think back, you know, like you're talking about the Bronze Derby with your, you know, folks. One for me, and it's kind of funny, was Win Schuler's in Marshall, Michigan. Win Schuler's is another, you know, cornerstone restaurant. And I think what's interesting, you know, full circle, my daughter Grace works there today. And it's a place that I remember growing up that was kind of like, you know, the Brown Derby for you. You just remember going there and, you know, probably didn't enjoy it a lot at the time, but you look back on it and it's fond memories.
Yeah.
But much like today, my friend, today will be a very fond memory for me. We're at the bottom of the hour, and we're going to have to wrap it up. Any closing thoughts? Any movie trivia you want to walk out with?
Oh, as far as movie trivia is concerned, the last one, I guess, would be about the movie Save the Tiger. With Jack Lemmon won an Academy Award for it. He was up against Pacino and Nicholson that year in other works. There is a scene in that movie that nobody has ever seen. When the movie starts off, he's at home, and he's heading out, and he has told you, if you don't know the plot to Save the Tiger, he is a failing businessman in the dress and garment industry, but he has been very successful, but kind of by dubious means. He is in a marriage that isn't doing much for him, and he is on the edge of a nervous breakdown. He takes off, heads out, and goes to see his mistress, who is young counterculture type, and then goes back, and we get on with the rest of the plot. According to Jack Lemmon, that scene was the best work he'd ever done. In fact, when they looked at the dailies, he told the director that that was what he wanted, something from that sent for Academy consideration. They wrap up the movie. The whole movie goes through. They put the score to it, and they send him a copy. He's in Europe with Billy Wilder, the director, and they view the movie. And he says, it's absolutely wonderful. Well, Billy's pacing. He's got his pipe in his mouth. And Lemmon asks him, what's wrong? He says, you know that scene with the mistress? It takes him completely off of his journey at a 90-degree angle, brings him back into the plot, and takes him out. He said, that's a really wonderful scene, but it completely destroys the momentum. I picked the scene out. And they went back and back and forth on it. But Jack Lemmon told, even though it was his work, he told everybody involved that if Billy told him to jump off a cliff making a movie, he'd do it. He trusts him 100%. If he says it breaks up the movie's momentum, we take it out. And they take it out. And not only did Lemmon win, but that movie was nominated for Best Picture of the Year. So you and I were talking earlier about editing. It's what you don't see, how they put it together, how it meets with the score. It's really making a symphony.
Yeah, and I think people, that really gets underappreciated by people, especially outside the industry. You know, film is much about editing, in my opinion, I mean, as it is about the actors and what goes in the can. And the reason I say that is it's amazing how many times, you know, you hear these stories over and over again. And, you know, there's people like Spielberg and Lucas that are notorious for their editing. Judd Apatow is notorious for his editing. I mean, he actually gets a lot of credit from people. In fact, I know people that send him stuff if they need it tweaked to try and pull something out. And he has that magic touch to be able to find those pieces and put them in. And it's amazing how many times you hear the stories about, you know, people that build, you know, scenes out of what comes off the cutting room floor. I mean, today it's all digital, but, you know, for people listening, cutting room floor used to refer to when everything was done on film, and, you know, they would literally physically cut it and seam it back together. But it is amazing how many times the editing saves a film. And, you know, that's something that to me has always been interesting. You know, we were joined today by Michael Blowen, former film critic for the Boston Globe, and my good friend Buck Wilson, talking movies, talking restaurants, talking, you know, life. And I can't thank you enough, Buck, for taking the time to join us. It's been a lot of fun. We got to do it again soon. We also got to figure out a way to get together soon, end up in the same spot for more than 10 minutes. So
sounds good.
I appreciate it very much. We're brought to you today by Tony's Steak and Seafood in Indianapolis, Buck's favorite town, Cincinnati, Lexington, Kentucky, and Bowling Green, Kentucky. Tony always says there's room at his table for one more. I always say dining at Tony's is an experience, not just dinner. You owe it to yourself to go. If you're anywhere near one of their restaurants, make a reservation. Take your friends. You'll thank us for it. We always support a few charities on this that are near and dear to us. We don't take a dime from any of them. No Fallen Heroes was brought to you by, you know, Wiz Buck with Matt Wiz Buckley and his lovely wife, Susie, the founders of No Fallen Heroes. They help veterans, first responders readjust to life. If you can't do a lot, please do a little. No Fallen Heroes is an amazing organization that helps people. And I can tell you firsthand, Matt does not take a penny. In fact, he puts a lot of his pennies into it. OldFriendsEquine.org, founded by our guest today, Michael Blowen, and his wife, Diane White. You know, another group that just does amazing work. And we could do an entire show on stories around old friends. So, you know, if you get a chance, take a look at those two. Tony's Steak and Seafood. For promotional products, we're brought to you by GoGaffey, GoGaffey.com. And we really appreciate everybody joining us today. This has been Hollywood and Horsepower. I'm Mark Otto. This has been Buck Wilson with us today. And thank you for taking the time, and we'll see you guys next week.
So stay a while. You're in the driver's seat where the road and the rhythm finally meet.
Stick around. You never know who's next. And trust me, they got a story worth hearing.